Yes, Honest Actors is back with brand new episodes every Friday. To help me continue releasing new episodes without a sponsor, or to say thanks for your favourite old ones, click the support link in the episode description. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. It's a one-off, feeling generous, good deed for the day sort of thing. Think of it as bumping into me and buying me a drink. To find out more, click the support link. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
Yeah, mine's a large red.
I hate those guys.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
My name is Kate Fleetwood, and you're listening to the Honest Actors Podcast.
Beautifully done. Nice spacing. Nice use of pace.
I thought I'd space it just
so very clear about your work. I mean, it's probably too long. I'll speed it up and you'll sound like a...
I'll sound like a cunt.
That stays. Hi, my name's Jonathan Harden, and this is At Long Last. I have waited 18 months to say this. Episode 1 of Series 3 of the Honest Actors Podcast, sponsored by TodayTix. More about that in a little bit, but before I let you hear this interview, I have to ask you a few little favours. You know the drill. First of all, if you could go onto social media and tell all your followers, your friends, your family, that the podcast is back and that it is worth checking out. All the things that you did for me in previous years, I would like you to go back and do one more time for me. You can also share your favourite moments from this interview and all the others that you remember that stand out for you using the hashtag best of honest actors. Don't know why I said hashtag twice there. The hashtag best of honest actors. Please do share something. I spend a lot of my time on my own making these things and putting them together. It's really lovely when I hear something back from you guys to say what bits you've enjoyed. So please do consider doing that. And in that vein, if you're feeling joyous, as is traditional at this time of year, or at least expected, you could always leave a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you find your podcast, should ratings and reviews be allowed. That would be hugely appreciated. The very last bit of business before I let you hear the interview is to tell you a little bit about our sponsor, TodayTix. Now, if you want great offers on theatre tickets, access to day seats on your mobile, exclusive front row lotteries, you need TodayTix in your life. It's the ticketing app that lets you see theatre differently. That has a capital S, a capital T, and a capital D. See theatre differently. That's their tagline. Catchy, isn't it? To get tickets with no queues and no fuss, download TodayTix now from the App Store and on Google Play. And so to the interview with Kate. I went to Kate Fleetwood's house on the 29th of September 2017. That's well over a year ago and the day before my birthday. It's also the day that, had I kept to the schedule, Series 3 of this podcast would have went out. You may have noticed that Series 1 and Series 2 both went out on the 30th of September as an odd little birthday gift to myself. That didn't happen last year, and one of the reasons was that in the way into Kate's house, I probably was as close as I've ever been to throwing in the towel and giving up acting. Less than 2 hours later, I emerged from the same front door feeling a lot more positive about what it is I do for a living whenever someone gives me the opportunity. So I hope that this interview can do the same for some of you out there. And even if you're not at that point, it's still well worth a listen. There's a great section midway through where Kate talks about coming out of what would be objectively seen as one of the more successful periods of her career to go into a prolonged period of unemployment. It is Honest Actors distilled to a single moment. So I hope you enjoy that in some kind of perverse way. Here it is, my interview with Kate Fleetwood. Enjoy.
So you probably know
That's a stupid assumption. Do you know the format of these at all?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I listened to all of them in the first series.
Second series was awful.
I didn't actually catch
album.
It. Well, yes. No, it was good. I've listened to a couple since.
I'm hoping series three is where it gets good again. Anyway, how did you start off? So going all the way back to the very beginning, what is your first entry point into acting?
Well, there are two entry points. There was one entry point when I was about five, because my parents moved from Cirencester, where I was born. They're actually from Liverpool, so all my family are Scousers, and they moved. My dad was a farm manager and my mum's a nurse. And we moved to Stratford-upon-Avon when I was four. And I went to the theatre really young because my dad used to get free tickets.
Okay.
Because we knew the firemen. And also we went on one of the days we sort of first started living there. And we went to Feed the Ducks. And my dad really sweetly, and they're not theatrical people. They're Scousers, so they're quite theatrical. but not professional. And we went to see a really famous production of Michael Bogdanoff's Taming of the Shrew. And we didn't actually see it. We just got some really cheap tickets at the back. And my dad said, hey, let's go and have a look at the back. We saw a matinee and my sister was six and I was like four. And we only went, we just ducked in the back for about 5 minutes, 10 minutes, something. And it was the beginning of the show. And so my first experience was, I don't know, you know, what might seem rather sort of classically middle class, but it wasn't really in the event of it. It was just we got some cheap stand-up tickets at the back for 10 minutes. And it was a famous show where Jonathan Pryce was playing Christopher Sly, sorry. And he was pulling down all the curtains. And
Can you still see it?
Yeah, I remember. I really visualise it. So it was a real light bulb moment went off.
Okay.
And I think kids are intuitive, and that's why I do believe you should take kids to theatre as soon as possible, because I think they are intuitive to how that form works. And I think my poor dad was like, oh, God, it's a mess, you know, because, like, the actor's, like, drunk and he's taking things off the stage and the audience is standing up going, my God, I've come from all the way from, like, Ohio to see the RSC. And Paola Diaconetti was dressed as an usherette. So it was the 70s, and so it was a time when, you know, I suppose that the relationship between audience and the artists and creatives on stage and behind stage were being tested. It was a very 70s thing, you know,
Peter
sort
Brook
of like, yeah,
thing
all that.
Of like, you know.
And not that I knew that at the time. I just remember thinking, this is really magical.
Yeah.
And this is really something else. And I'd like to be part of it.
Please.
Please. Thank you very much. And,
so what happens then? Like, how
so then nothing
there?
Really happened.
So then?
Then nothing happened. And then, but we were really fortunate, like I say, because we knew the firemen. And at those times, you'd always have a fireman backstage at the RSC or any of these big shows. And they'd all, everyone in those days, you don't get it, where everyone used to get two comps per show or something like that, like years ago, because it's the big thing now, isn't it? When you do a show, everyone thinks you get comps all the time. You've had your comp, have I? So we were lucky. We got to see a lot of free theatre, really. And it was during this, the RSC time, that it was sort of halcyon years of, you know, I saw, you know, brilliant, amazing, memorable shows. Nicholas Nickleby, and I used to, you know, Roger Rees was like a big hero. And then I loved, you know, all those actresses that just were, they were my pinups, you know, Juliet Stevenson and Fiona Shaw and Sinead Cusack. And they were my pinups, really. I was a bit of a geek about it.
So then, like, so you you go from watching something at the back at a very young age, thinking this looks exciting, I want to get involved, to kind of seeing more, identifying people as role models and heroes, mm-hmm. heroines. Are you simultaneously then on a track that's taking you towards that, or is it still you on the outside watching it happen?
Well, I remember at my primary school, we did a little sort of play, and it was a PTA sort of thing where the kids made something up and then the parents made something up, and we did I mean, I hadn't thought about it for ages, but it was the I think it's the first time I performed, and I played Ruth Madoc in IDI, and I had little glockenspiel, ding, 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 and I managed to sort of pass a Welsh accent age 10 or something.
Yeah.
And the audience was, yeah, they laughed, and it felt right. It just felt really exciting, and I loved the process of, even then, I loved the process of making it and inventing it with everybody. And I remember just thinking, oh, this feels comfortable. This doesn't feel like I'm out of some kind of comfort zone, and I'm happy to perform. And of course, I loved the roar of the crowd and all of that, but it was more, it felt incredibly visceral, physical, the reaction to it. And so I started to, and then we'd do another school play and another school play, and then I started to really get involved in that. So I suppose mentally, I was like, that became a dream. And
To do it professionally,
I don't think I quite worked at that point, but I just was, I think I became rather addicted to the process of it.
So like, because it is that thing about, you know, every kid paints but doesn't necessarily decide that they want to do painting as a job, and every kid plays football but doesn't necessarily think they want to do football as a job. And at what point do you go from being a kid who does school shows to being a young person who thinks, this is going to pay my bills?
Well, I sort of played Joseph in the school play of Joseph and His Amazing Dream Coat.
Drunk. You were drunk.
I was drunk playing it, and I can never remember the colours of my coat. This is far too many. And we did a joint, a co-production. We did a co-production with Punch Drunk. No, we did a co-production production with the next door neighbor school. And we auditioned, and I got the part of Joseph, and I thought this was really thrilling. And then we
could, quite forward thinking as well.
I was like, and it also meant I was rehearsing in the day during school hours, and that seemed to be just really great, this idea that we could spend your days making something.
While other people are working.
While
the fools are working.
Yeah, and it felt other and interesting and exciting.
That.
And
you're making me want to do it again.
You know, you're like... And then, so we performed that, and then I moved into a secondary school, and I sort of knew by that point, primary school and junior school, there was a community show that was going on produced by the RSC. So I hadn't really thought about the RSC much. I mean, occasionally we'd go and see the odd play, and I knew it was there, and it wasn't sort of, we were constantly going and discussing theatre and art in our house. We weren't. We were just having a bit of a laugh. And my sister's a musician. We were always just singing and mucking about. And there had been this community show called The Dylan, which was written by a local woman.
Okay.
Which was produced by the RSC at the other place, which at that time was still the Tin Shed. Mm-hmm. And they used local people to play the young kids and locals and residents of Stratford, and mixed with a professional company produced and directed by Barry Kyle at the time. And I hadn't really heard of that first one, though my mum had taken me for a walk around old town Stratford, and I remember thinking, oh, there's loads of kids in this.
Why am I not in this?
Well, is that possible that you can be a child actor as well? And so I might have made some noises about that to mum and dad. And then about a year later, my mum saw an advert in the Stratford Herald and said, oh, they're auditioning for the sequel to The Dylan, which is a thing called Mary After the Queen, which is about Mary, a little girl called Mary, named after the Queen. And they're going to do The Dylan again, but they're going to do Mary After the Queen as well. And so there's an audition for local kids. Shall we go along? Because I know that's the kind of thing you're into. And I went and played lots of exercises and games and things, which was a kind of complete new world. Wow, it's that Boeing.
Ooh.
Ooh, 70,
I was like 19
70s
when
games.
I first played Zip-Zap Boeing, and I was like, this is going to change my life. Family parties at Christmas. Okay, everyone.
Yeah, I think we did that exercise where you go into the middle of the room and you pretend to hold an object and you make it into something, then you pass it on.
Oh,
and the invisible.
Passing the ball
invisible,
of energy.
Yeah, that thing.
Lovely.
And I remember feeling a bit devastated because they called everyone's names out and they said, and they pulled my name out, but then they kept calling everyone's names out of the people they'd asked to stay behind and said, oh yeah, you're all going to be in the Dylan. And then I was like, well, I'm not going to be in anything then. No, that's it then, is it? And then they went, and everyone had left and they went, we'd like you to play Little Mary in Mary After the Queen.
Brilliant.
So I was really like, was like,
first RSC credit.
It was my first credit. So I did a professional production of this play, and it just really changed my life. I mean, I just saw how you worked professionally, and I loved being in a rehearsal room with Ron Cook and all these people. And then all the actors I spoke to, I would ask advice. What should I do? This is what I want to do. This is what I want to do. And they all said to me, don't go to drama school. Don't go to drama school.
Who said that?
All of them.
The actors of the RSC?
Like, all of them said, don't go to drama school, which, you know, later on became a bit of an issue.
Did you not?
I didn't, no.
Wow.
And I sort of just...
I say, well, I'm near to the day, so it sounded like I was judging you with my wow. But that's the industry has built me up to judge people. Like, oh, you didn't train.
Oh, you did? Well, I know. Oh, it tells.
Yeah. Well, often the only person in a company.
That, yeah. It's so getting less so that, yeah. though, isn't it? But, I sort of put it to bed and decided that I was going to really concentrate on my just being at school. And I went to a really great arty school in Leamington Spa, which was really interested in drama. And I made plays and worked and did theatre studies. It was theatre studies, really, that kept me going.
I love to hear stuff like that.
Theatre studies. So I gave up my professional aspirations at that point. And I just knew that I was definitely going to be an actor. No one at school knew me as anything else. That was what I was going to do.
Great.
And then went to university, not to drama school, because I couldn't afford to go to drama school. And at the time, and it was annoying because it was, I lived in Warwickshire and they made so much money out of...
Do you regret not going? You said it's become a bit of a problem later.
It did.
I start to feel sometimes like it does with certain jobs. So like with theatre, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think I think it has held me back, or that's my perception of it in some ways. But do you regret not going to drama school?
I did for years. Yeah, I did. Because I was lucky when I came out of university, because I did a drama degree and it was not a vocational course at all. And I came out of drama school not knowing that I had to have an agent, that I needed a 10x8, that I'm probably going to have to get the massive gap in my teeth filled, which I did like 10 years later when I could afford it. And I knew nothing about the business side of it. And it was a problem. I was lucky in the sense that, I mean, my university course was very practical, but it wasn't vocational. So we were doing a lot of different forms of theatre. We were hugging trees and doing Grotowski and Meyerhold and Commedia dell'arte and all sorts of things. And, you know, it was really broad, but we never put on plays. And I had to keep it really quiet at university that I wanted to be a mainstream actor. It was kind of frowned on in those days. I mean, having your own theatre company was the thing.
De rigueur.
De rigueur, but I was very lucky that I got a break in the sense that a director saw me because he was interested in the form of theatre I'd been working in the first year of university, which was Commedia dell'arte. And he was interested in working with a practitioner that was working with us, and he came to see our sharing. They weren't called plays or showing.
It was a sharing. Yep.
And he came and
it's
he
not
sent
about
a
product, yeah, it's about process
totes at that. I mean, it really, really was. And he sent a message back saying, I'd like to work with you when you leave. Which was lucky.
Right. I was funny.
I know it's the only first year.
I was literally on my way out the door.
Yeah. So I was lucky. I got a job with the Oxford Stage Company, when I left university, and I did 3 years apprentice, if you like,
at
on Oxford. The road.
Okay, lovely.
Yeah, on the road.
So this is the bit where we transition into something mm-hmm. different.
Yeah.
And before we do that, I always ask the same question, which is. And this is by way of identifying you, and you will have heard this before, and it's unfair, and I introduce it as such because I know it's unfair and I know I would struggle to answer it, and you'd never ask a question as an interviewer that you'd struggle to answer yourself, but fuck it, I'm not the person to answer, okay? The question is, if you could pick one project to stand for you, and you can interpret that any way you wish. For example, it could be that the thing you think people think most highly of, the thing you feel most highly of, or the thing that people will never have heard of, but you wish you could do more of. So you can pick it for whatever reason you like. And obviously, I'll say at the start that anybody who hasn't been mentioned or a show that hasn't been picked shouldn't feel offended, because there's huge pressure on you to pick one thing, right? So I've got you off the hook, okay? So if you could pick one thing to stand for you in some way and to identify you to the people that are listening that might not be aware of you, what would it be?
It would be Macbeth. For lots of reasons. It would be Macbeth because we didn't know that that show was going to be so well received, and so it was just so complete as an idea, as a vision, and the company and how it was interpreted and how it moved and the journey it took from being in a rehearsal room, then going to the Minerva at Chichester, then going into the West End, then going to BAM, then going to Broadway, and then making a movie of it. That kind of genesis of a project, you never know that that's going to happen when you start a job. And every step we took was always a surprise. It was never laid out that was ever going to be the journey. So everything was always just like,
every beat.
Are you joking?
Yeah.
That's now happening. So that, for the journey of that, was really just something really special. And of course, the company was just, we were all just like kids.
How long did that last for?
Over a period of 2.5 years, from the beginning to the end. And you know, I wasn't slated to do that job, you know. Someone else was late and they pulled out, and I auditioned for it because
God bless. Nothing I love more than when someone says, you know, someone else has pulled out. Do you mind? And you think, do I fuck?
Of course. That's part of the, you know, that it's one of the things that you have to accept.
You have to embrace that you're very rarely first choice.
And other people's crumbs might be, you know, your feast. And
that's nice. I like that.
And, well, thank you.
I'll edit it out. What I'll do is, at the end of the interview, I'll say, I think what we've learned is that
good.
Other people's crumbs can be our feast. I'll leave that with you, listeners. Until next time. I'm going to turn into Jerry Springer this time. Johnny's final thought.
So that's sort of, if one job makes a difference to your career, probably did make a difference. You know, I'd be foolish and disingenuous to say it didn't make a difference, because suddenly people went, hello. And that's all.
You haven't made a drama school, suddenly we don't care.
Yes, sort of, actually, quite frankly. People went, oh, right, so you haven't been at the RSC for the last, even though I'm constantly trying to get into the RSC for years. And, but, you know, I auditioned for it. I think people might not realise that I did that. And I did a few auditions because I didn't want, I think that's the big thing about being an actor, and is that you don't want to be cast, you don't want to be a square peg in the wrong hole. You know, it's got to be right.
Yeah.
It's got to be right. Otherwise, it'll be tough. So that job is the obvious one. But then there is another job. And I think the lucky thing about when I look back is that you think when you have a big success like that, or the show has a big success like that, is that you'll never experience that again.
I was going to ask that, which is, does a job like that make it harder to go back to auditioning for jobs that you might not feel so passionate about, to perhaps after 2.5 years of working something that's constantly getting better and every corner you turn open something new and exciting, to going back to even a short period of unemployment?
Well, actually, the truth about that was it was a really long period of unemployment after that, which is the irony. And something, it's actually not ironic, it's actually quite common that you can have what would be seen as a sort of like a success. Because it was a success in lots of ways, and maybe not so much in others. Because I think it's really rare that one job transforms an actor's life. I think it does happen, but I don't think it's often. I think it's little thing, just, you know, culmination of lots of things rather than just one bingo, you know, lottery. It's really rare that anyone wins the lottery.
Yeah.
And it works like that. So I went to New York and I, you know, got nominated for a Tony, and I hope that's not like it was kind of really exciting and amazing, and I never thought ever that that kind of thing would ever happen. And then I came home and I didn't get an audition for a year, which felt like, oh, but it was a really good lesson.
Didn't you guys hear about Tony?
You're like,
I mean, I know I didn't win, but like, come on, guys.
I thought maybe, maybe I might get a meeting somewhere. No, didn't get a meeting for a theatre job for a year.
So what is that? What is that feel like in that period? Having had that 2.5 years of camaraderie, of constant employment, of income, of self-worth, I suppose.
Yeah.
Like, what happens in a 12-month period then when nobody's knocking your door? I mean,
it's tough. It's really tough because, of course, all the validation and stuff. I mean, we all tell each other you can't validate yourself through your work and stuff.
Yeah,
but it's kind. I don't. I think people do, and that's not about.
I think everybody does.
Yeah, I don't think that's about saying, oh, you know, you're at a party and you're like, at least you know what you're going to say. I think it's just when you're at home on your own.
I think,
like a lot of actors are.
It doesn't matter who you are. They're an actor or a plumber or a nurse or like having no purpose.
Yeah.
Is deathly.
And I think that's the real problem I've found over the years, and I've got better at it. And I think is that if you've got nothing to hang your hat on, it's really grim.
Yeah, agreed.
And I think if you, even if it's just an audition coming up, that's something you've got to hang a hat on. You've got a purpose. Okay, I've got a script to read. I can research this, or I can, you know, whatever. Having something to hang your hat on as an actor is just
Or I can at least, at the very least, I have something to force me to clean the house so I don't have to start thinking about it.
Exactly.
I get something
I can procrastinate from.
Yeah,
it's something
exactly.
I can procrastinate from.
Exactly, yeah.
So, yeah, so that was, it was a year. And in fact, I had had a really long period of unemployment after I'd had my first child. And I'd done a telly, I think. And then I remember I was in this kitchen and I got a call, and it was about, God, I think it was over a year that I hadn't done something which I was substantially doing, you know, and I was like, oh, now this is, you know, is this going to ever work out, you know? And this is before Macbeth, and I got a phone call and it was an offer. Like, I've only ever had 3 offers in my career. So, but I remember getting a call and getting offered a job, and it had been about a year and over a year, and I literally fell to my knees because that's the release.
Fucking hell.
I fell to my knees. I mean, it's probably a bit dramatic, but.
Well, I love those moments. Do you know why I love those? Do you know why I love those moments? Because I remember the first, at one time in my life, I've fallen to my knees.
Oh, go on.
And I was in tears.
Yeah.
Over something bad. And I fell to my knees, and the first thought I had was like,
oh, use that.
Almost exactly that was, oh, fuck, if a director told me to do that, I would say, no one ever does that in real life. And then I went, oh, I'll use that. And I remember also on another occasion being really distraught in tears and thinking, I must go and look in the mirror.
Well, I was about to say the same thing. Because I think that is what being an actor is. It's not, it's lots of other things, you know,
it's
listeners.
Like that level of like.
I remember being a kid.
Yeah.
And being. Bawling my eyes out and keeping the face.
What's this face
look like? What's this face look like? And going upstairs and looking in the mirror. So, yeah, it's hard. That's the funny thing about being an actor, isn't it? Is that, of course, your emotions are real and your reactions are real, but.
Can you use that?
Sometimes. Well, I could use that.
Or watching someone else in a kind of terrified state and thinking, yeah, that's interesting.
That is what terror looks like.
I'll watch for 10 seconds, then I'll help.
Yeah.
I just need to watch this for a bit longer.
Well, how long is that?
Yeah.
But the thing about, if you think about, excuse me.
It's all right. Just unclip yourself.
Just unclip yourself.
Buy tickets to the best theatre in London and in lots of other cities, including New York and many others. The New Way. With the Tinnitus app, getting great offers and access to exclusive tickets has never been easier. With Tinnitus Rush, you won't have to queue at the box office for hours to get day seats, and you can access big savings with their lotteries for shows like... Let me have a little look at my app here. You can filter this. So hold on, let me see. I'll filter it by plays only, because that's the kind of dude I am. You've got A Very, Very, Very Dark Matter from 15 quid. You've got The Inheritance from 15 quid. True West from 18 quid. Betrayal featuring Tom Hiddleston for £18. And lots of other stuff as well. Curious Incident, Harry Potter. It is the app you need so that you can afford to go to theatre in London. Check it out. Tinnitus. Download it today. The theatre ticket app from the App Store and Google Play. And see theatre differently.
So the boots have arrived?
The boots have arrived, yeah. Secondhand boots from eBay.
And you've just kind of mentioned in passing there a couple of minutes ago about boots. Yeah, can we see those? I mean, they won't be so good on the podcast, but I'll describe them, and I'm pretty confident I have the skills necessary to really communicate those to an audience via only language.
Aural texture.
In jokes already, we've only been together for an hour. So you'd said about that kind of reward, I suppose, or the breaking of a monotony that comes with getting an audition when you haven't had one for a while, and that it gives you something to focus and hang your hat on and work on, and at least you feel like you're acting. Does that mean then you enjoy that process? Does that mean that you enjoy the kit? Something's come in, such and such wants to see you on Friday morning for such and such. We're going to send through the scripts later today. That kind of carry on. Do you get excited by that? I mean, obviously, depending on the job, is that something you enjoy doing?
Yeah, I really enjoy. I think most actors would admit this, is that yes, absolutely. Oh, great, great. Oh, fantastic. Oh, great. Can I read the scripts? And now I've got to learn 19 sides, you know, in an hour, you know, or whatever. It's one of the things that most actors I talk to, my mates or whatever, we find most frustrating, is that you get, you know, you have to read 4 episodes or something and learn 12 sides by 10 o'clock tomorrow. And if you've got any other life going on, it's really, really hard. I don't like learning lines for auditions at all, you know, because it just doesn't feel creative, because you're not with anybody and you're not making it with somebody. But I do enjoy reading scripts and things. I mean, as long as it doesn't go, your character nods head on page 2 and by page 4, your character's head falls off, you know, and you're like, yeah. Oh, right, okay.
Okay.
You do get excited, but there's a practical side to it as well.
Do you get nervous?
Well, I used to get nervous about it. I think the thing is, you know, you're like, I didn't train at university. I pretty much trained on the job. And then it's like, well, I don't know what I'm going to do on set. But I think most actors feel that. You know, there's no... You just better to turn up and do it, you know.
Yeah, well, a lot of people who've been doing it, like...
You're like, fuck. It's hard, those first years. I'm much more comfortable on a set now. But it took a long time.
Did you get nervous about auditions? Have you got nervous about...
Well, I used to, and then I've found a way not to. Which is to treat any audition like a rehearsal, so that, you know, it's fine to get it wrong. And as long as you're having a dialogue and discussion with the director or the casting director, and if you're lucky, you know, they'll be up for that. And you just treat it psychologically as if you're in a rehearsal room.
Do you know when it's gone well?
No. You always get it wrong. Always get that wrong. I mean, you know, you can have amazing, and then you don't hear anything.
Like when you do, do you do self-tapes a lot at home?
No, I don't. I've only just started doing that.
Do you watch them back?
Nope. I hate looking at myself.
You're lying to me, Kate.
I'm not, because I don't do it on my own. Fortunately, my agent's got a room.
Okay.
It's all set up. Lovely. And a lovely agent, his assistant.
Lovely.
It helps me out. And I go in and I do it as quick, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not...
They take care of it. You're not in control, so that's
fine. So I go, ugh. But if I were to be at home with it, I might a quick look and about the framing. That's what I'll do. And go, oh, well, I better just...
check the framing there.
Better just do a bit less. So yeah, obviously you always just want to get in the room with the director. That's the aim, because then you build up some kind of relationship, and then you can work. They can see if they can work with you or not. But I mean, every actor's got about a million audition stories, which are just, I mean, they're a scream, you know. And I mean, you know, auditions where you've had to pretend to have AIDS and you're lying on the floor, kind of like begging on the floor, and the agent's assistant goes, "Oh, you're really good at having AIDS." Or, and you're like, and they go, "Oh, I'm so glad you don't have AIDS." Or, you know, and you're like, "Oh, is this for real?" You know, yeah. Or the lovely, lovely casting directors, they go, "Okay, so if you'd like to just, so I'll indicate the moment when the alien comes in and, grabs your baby from you," and you're sitting there, and they go,
"Or you get thrown against the wall."
And you're like, that is the, having to do action in an audition is my work. I'm almost getting to a point now where I go, I'm not going to do the action. And I don't know whether they think I'm being grand or not. I'm just like, I'm just going to look like a dick.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't got a gun.
Yeah.
I don't know who I'm talking to.
I turned up to an audition for a franchise we talked about earlier. And I don't do actions. Right, but I'm the kind of guy that panics when I see what other people are doing. So, like, if I don't have a moustache and a handsome moustache, I'm like, fucking should have grown the moustache
in the hour in 12 I had. Hours.
Right, or if everybody else is like wearing a white shirt and it's a scientist and I've just gone in t-shirt, I'd be like, fucking everyone else. Like,
I'm like that with my hair. I should have put the hair up.
If I had the confidence to, I would probably stop one of them on the way out and say, "Can I borrow your white shirt? I'll give you a tenner." Like, I'm that guy, just panic. So there was a load of guys walking into this audition, and they had prop guns.
Oh my God.
Right. So they had one of the guys had a prop gun, another guy had a walking stick. And I started to shit myself because I was like, I didn't bring a gun. Like, I'm a fucking idiot. So I'm like fucking fishing around. Like, and in the audition waiting room, I see there's an umbrella.
So not like, a mop. Oh, I thought you were saying
not
mop.
An umbrella. So I walk into the casting with an umbrella, thinking this is gonna fucking I can't believe I've rescued this from the jaws of defeat, right? And the casting director was like, "Did you lift that from outside? Because it was his
umbrella."
And I went, "Yeah." And he goes, "Please don't." He says, "If you didn't bring one, that's better. Everyone else just looks like an absolute tit." Because your guy's going.
Oh, out. At least you looked like you weren't a tip because you didn't bring it.
Yeah, because he recognised it. Because if I'd brought my own, he rescued me from myself.
Oh.
But honest to God, I'll if somebody's outside.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you hear the stories of people a friend of mine in Belfast once got cast as a nun because he dressed as a nun and turned up the audition. And I remember everybody ridiculing it at the time until she got the call. And you're like, oh, right.
I should have gotten that.
Right. Oh, shit. But you just never know, because sometimes that makes you look like an absolute freak. And other times they're like, I can't believe
it's so hard. It's like pinning the tail on the donkey, isn't it?
Yeah, because you don't.
You're just like, I have no idea whether I should go at, you know, a little genuflection, don't they say? Just a little genuflection towards, a little nod to the character. And you're...
Jeans instead of a dress, or a dress instead of jeans.
Maybe I should have...
Or hair up.
Maybe I should have done the hair up. Or then I went through a period of going in with my hair down and then having a bungee thing on my arm and just casually putting my hair up halfway through so they could get kind of a bit of a dub.
Yeah.
And then going, oh God. And then, of course, the other technique I use in auditions, which is one, is to treat it like a rehearsal, and that just takes all the nerves away because it just feels like you're actually just working rather than being tested. Is I just never look at the list. I'll do everything I can do to not see that list.
No, because those are people who you would cast ahead of you.
Of course,
those are people you'll go, oh, she's good.
Of course. So I just, if they see it and they go, name, and you're like, I don't want to see it. And I try and go in right on time. I don't want to see.
No, I try that as well.
Never want to see that person coming out.
I always try that as well. Yesterday I had one of somebody came out and I just kept my head down.
That's it.
Because I thought, I don't want to see what he looks like. I don't want to see that he looks better,
better than me. Yeah. I don't want to see that they've decided to go that way with it.
Yeah.
And then there's that thing about coming out of auditions and, you know, you could literally walk into a bus and you wouldn't notice, you know. Mm. So I've stopped. So what I do is I make sure I'm sort of safe in a shop. I mean, I won't buy anything, but I'll just make sure I'm sort of in a shop without any traffic in it. Because you can come out of an audition and just be like, I have no idea how that went. Oh, and replaying it in your head and going,
doing the lines.
Oh my God.
Doing
and the traffic's
better.
Going, when you could just get run over and you wouldn't even notice.
It's my, I think statistically, I'm not sure how many actors have been run over in the way out of auditions, but I mean, if it was going to happen, it would happen to me, is the thing, because I'm actually like, doing the scene better every time.
Yeah, oh, always.
Without fail. Yesterday, I had to stop myself because I was walking down Portobello Road like, but giving it Dixie. Whereas on the way in, I was too frightened to like give it Dixie because it was like, I don't want people thinking I'm a weirdo. But after you come out, your awareness of the world is
doesn't it?
Like, so you're outside, like, basically, you know, with a gun to your head, going, please don't fucking shoot me. And everyone's like, what is that guy's fucking, what is that guy's doing? Anyway.
Go on.
Go on. I think you'll have good ones of these. What's your bugbear feedback?
Oh, bugbear feedback?
Like, do you ever hear anything back regularly that annoys you?
No, because you don't hear any feedback now.
Never?
I mean, they just went another way. That's all you ever hear, don't you? They just went another way. In fact, I was talking to a director.
They're going a completely different direction. But
why did they call me in then?
No, I heard one.
That's what I always think. Is like, if they're going to go in a completely different direction, why did I bother reading 6 episodes?
Well, here's the thing.
Learning all that, sorting out childcare. If you knew you were going to go in a completely different direction, why am I here?
How completely different can they go? He's 37, Northern Irish. Fair hair, an average build. Completely different direction can they possibly go?
And then you might sort of watch it when it comes out, thinking, well, who did they cast in that tiny role that I auditioned for? Oh, they look exactly like me.
Yeah, they went in exactly the same direction, but just not mine. Yeah.
But I don't know about this feedback thing, because I don't know. I won't say that because it feels a bit personal, but no feedback, or just like,
does that annoy you?
Well, it used to annoy me, and now I just think, of course, I think that you have to accept. I think that's what I've got better at. I've just got better at going, just letting it go. So after I feel like I might get run over,
okay,
I give myself like, it used to be maybe like a week or two, I'd be kind of going, well, I've only just had the audition.
Yeah, but that's different. I mean, feedback is different to hearing whether or not you've got it, right? So I think with feedback, there's an implication that you're going to get we felt like she was a bit too
big, no.
or she, we felt like she was a bit too young, or we felt like we, you know, were, that's feedback. But actually,
I quite like that straight away. You know, when I go into an audition, it's just I'd like them to
just go. Because they know, don't they?
Because they know. Yeah. I'd really like to pick up my bag. I leave my bag. That's another thing, is leave my bag. Leave everything out of the room. Because there's a really good chance I'll forget it and have to knock on the door and go, I left my bag. Sorry.
And just walk in at the point where they're going, terrible.
Absolutely. Oh, my God. Who thought
the worst. Okay.
Who got... Hi. What was I saying?
You were saying that you leave everything outside.
So leave everything outside. Yeah, and at that point when you just get to the door and finally say goodbye, I just would like to say, it's fine. If it's a no, can you just tell me now? And then we just let it go, and then you don't have to worry about, you know. It's more than fine. It's absolutely fine.
In fact,
it's
going to
be
close?
A logistical nightmare if I get this.
Yeah,
so,
I'm not even sure I want it.
Do you know?
I read the scripts. I wasn't mad keen. Let's be honest with each other, okay? Do you want to hire me?
Yeah.
Because then I can make a decision based on that and whether or not I think it's actually...
But I think what the truth is that I don't think you'll ever get any truthful feedback. Because I don't think people... more often than not now, it'll take so long to get things going, and it'll be because so-and-so is now going to be in it, or they're waiting on an offer coming in from that person. And there's often it's not really like, oh, you were this, and they're just thinking about that. They don't know until so-and-so says yes. And so it's a bit like worrying, scratching a sort of wall or bottom of a door that, you know, the people behind the door probably don't know yet either.
Yeah, so, I mean, sometimes it does take a long time. Sometimes they know in days. I don't know if you've ever seen auditions for anything involving, because I have, because my wife's involved in telly, and she gets to watch the odd
set of audition tapes, and it's kind of fascinating because most people do exactly the same read in spite of what they might think. And
that's interesting.
And usually it's immediately apparent that that person is more appropriate rather than quite sometimes it's that they're better, but most is more appropriate. That's how we see the part. But I know one director who writes letters, and so I did something recently and I was casting and I made the point of writing little two-line emails to everybody that came in.
Amazing.
It took me all of
half an hour,
20 minutes to write like 15 emails, like little short. Thanks for coming in. It's really great to meet you. I'm sorry it didn't go this way, but you know, really appreciate it. It was genuinely nice to meet you. Because it's always nice to meet. It's no lie there. But then everybody replies because they're like, because they're so fucking shocked. And it's not like I'm Steven Spielberg. Like, I'm just an actor who decided that we're going to do a short film. Like, it's like, but I was like, oh yeah, thanks. Really. And part of me goes, is it because they're going, maybe he's going to do another one and let's keep him sweet. But then I think genuinely, I know I've done it when that one director wrote to me. It's like, what time does it actually take? Like, because if it takes too long, you're seeing too many actors.
Right, yeah.
You know, like, you spent 3 days in a room, give it one more hour to say, ta. Yeah. I'll email their agent.
No, I mean, of course, I think that, but maybe I've just got a bit hardened to it. I got Jonathan Harden about it, sort of, just like,
nice.
I just like, you know, I don't expect it. So if it's, I mean, what we all get is like, still in the running.
Yeah.
still in the mix. What you get a lot of is you're still in the mix. Then maybe I've got to go on for 2 or 3 weeks, and then you'll get like, oh no, they went another way about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
I had about 4 weeks ago, audition for a part, and the part, the guy needed to have a big beard. So I had a reasonable beard at the time, and they said, listen, can you keep the beard?
Right. Yeah.
And I'm whole time thinking, I'm not fucking paid to keep this beard. I kind of was going to keep the beard anyway, but part of me then really wanted to shave it off because I was thinking, so a week goes by, another audition comes in. I said to my agent, that's great. Can I get rid of this beard that I'm not getting paid to keep? And he went, no, I'll check. He comes back, no, you're still in the mix. They'll just keep it. You can trim it, right? You can fucking trim it. It's my fucking face. And also nobody's paying me to be gracious enough to go, I'm going to keep the hairy face in the reasonably warm London summer. That's fine. And then like 2 weeks passes and it's like, and I'm starting to get a wee bit passive aggressive about it. Like, so can I trim this beard now?
Yeah.
You can trim it, but don't lose it because you're still in the mix. Right. And then eventually the news isn't, you haven't got the job. The news is, hey, Jonathan, yeah, you can shave the beard off.
All right, yeah. It's like, that's one way of putting it.
So I haven't got
it.
I know. Anyway, enough about me and my beard. An agent once told me,
oh,
an actor's only ever truly happy in the 5 minutes. I love the fact that this has become a thing now. An agent's only ever truly happy in the 5 minutes after they get a job, and then the self-doubt kicks in. Now, do you recognise yourself in that? And if you don't, what kind of things do you start to think about 5 minutes after the elation, let's say,
the dropping to the knees moment?
Once you've dropped to your knees, clocked like, oh, it and thought, I can use this,
what will probably happen is I go, my knees. Like, oh, how can I use this?
Do you doubt yourself?
Can I use this in the part I've just been offered? Yeah. Dropping to my knees.
Interesting. Do you doubt yourself then? Like, you've talked about being a square peg in a round hole. Even when someone said, you're a round peg, do you still think, I don't know, maybe I'm a square peg? Like, is there that level of, I don't know if I'm right for this?
Oh, yeah. And I'm not... I always think that with screen work. Be honest, I think that... I just think I don't really have a massive screen career, and so I'm just like, oh, someone's been really nice there and given me that job, and so I get a bit anxious about that. But theatre, yeah, I mean, I mean the elation lasts. To be honest, the elation sort of lasts a bit longer than 5 minutes. I might enjoy it for an afternoon.
Have a little glass of wine. We do that
later on. And then the visualizing starts. That's what happens. Like, of course I doubt. Yeah, of course I don't. Because then suddenly you're like, and the worst thing to do, I think the worst thing to do is when you've got a big theatre job where you're going to be playing like a massive character, which is requiring all sorts of elements to it, which are really like either, you know, you've got to accomplish that, master that, the accent, then that physical side of the character's got to sort out. It's a lot of things that one has to accomplish and try and achieve to make this character. The worst thing to do is then go to the theatre that night, because I always watch people on stage and think, oh my God, that looks so nerve-wracking.
Do you?
Yeah.
I just think it looks amazing.
I always think amazing, and oh my God, I wish I was on there.
Every time I think about giving up, I just think, oh, but being on stage.
Yeah, it's so amazing. And then, but then you go and you think, oh God, you know, how did they manage to, like, they were so deft at that speech, and oh my God, that choice is incredible, or, you know, the way that chemistry is working, that's astonishing, and oh my God, what are they doing on that set, or whatever, you know, and then I go, whoa, I'll be doing that in maybe like 8 weeks, you know. So I try to keep myself away from things once I get a job. I won't be, not because I just immediately get involved. Like, it's the first thing I do is I'll get a job and I'll go straight onto Amazon.
Order books.
And
like, our shelves are full of books I've never read about Russian fucking, you know,
the Victorian Revolution. Or, yeah. You know,
and you read, like, you go to the index, read the bits you need to read, because you're like, shit, I only have 2 weeks and I've got to learn all the lines. But for some reason, I procrastinate. It's useful procrastination, but you're just.
But it is procrastination. Yes, it's doing the thing that you can do to that isn't the actual thing.
It isn't the actual thing. It's not.
So yeah, so I do a lot of sort of visualizing. So I'll visualize a bit, like, you know, I suppose sports people do, don't they?
Yeah.
So I'll be visualizing myself in that space.
Yeah.
Sort of doing that in that role.
Well,
I don't know we will be doing or how, what decision we make, but I get I'm quite a future thinker. You know, I'm always planning.
Yeah.
So I sort of, yeah, that's what's going on in the first few hours of. And also just delight. I mean, absolutely. The phone my mum, phone my dad, phone my mum and dad, you know, get really excited. It's a great thing.
Shop for a pair of boots for opening night.
Pair of boots on eBay.
I mean, it always feels good. So jump then to opening night happens. Yay. Come off stage. You know, go to some crappy party somewhere.
Drink ridiculous, horrible wine.
Yes, exactly. Eat just nibbles that you don't really want.
Too leany.
Yeah, exactly. You're fancy. And then... 2-3 days later, Quentin Letts, you know, gives his righteous opinion. Do you read it?
I don't read them straight away.
Do you read it during production when you feel a bit more secure?
I don't read them all. I don't sit down and go, right, I'm reading the reviews now. But they come. I do it sort of in dribs and drabs.
You don't avoid them.
I don't avoid them. I think it's impossible. I think it's really hard to avoid them. And also, it's hard being in a group, you know,
where some people have read it.
Yeah, and sort of going, don't talk to me. It's one of,
darling,
you know, because then people have to be sort of overly sensitive around
you.
I wouldn't want other people to have to kind of tiptoe around me. So you can kind of tell, can't you? You can tell how the. You can't tell whether it's a 1-star or a 3-star or I don't know.
I think you can tell whether it's 2 stars or 4.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, and you go into work the next day and you're like, you know.
And also, I think then, like you say, if one person's read it, it filters very quickly.
It does.
I think the vast majority of any company will read reviews.
I think so.
I think certainly people with smaller parts always read reviews because they want to see if they're mentioned. I think it's less likely if you're the lead because you're not ready for it yet.
There's that. And there is that thing, which is, you know, oh, it's great when so-and-so does that thing with her hand and whatever. And then,
oh, the
and
hand it, thing
and, you know,
is
that
working.
Thing, you know, you're like, oh, right, that, oh, that, oh, that's my, where's my hand?
It's the reviewer. Yeah,
it's the hand that got mentioned or whatever.
Enter
and
hand.
So, yeah, enter hand, chased by a
followed by
and bear.
Standby hand. Go hand.
Could you make your hand a bit smaller, please?
Have you ever Googled yourself?
Yeah.
What kind of stuff comes up that make, like, what alarms you? If you're anything?
I think the thing about, because I'm not a big social media person, But I'm on Twitter and you get those notifications now, don't you? I think I should turn that. So I don't Google myself. I might Google if something's been announced, I might want to just see how that announcement's gone down, or like whether people are interested in the project or whatever. But I don't kind of sit at home kind of Googling.
Kate, nothing there. Catherine.
No, I mean, it's funny all that, isn't it? It's like getting feedback.
Do you Google friends?
No, I Google projects. So I'll Google projects. Well, I want to keep him, just keep up. No, I don't Google friends. No,
I don't. I think we've said Google a lot
Google.
Of times.
Google.
It feels like it's a
I
ridiculous
I want to say it like
word,
you
no.
said. Google. Google.
I wasn't aware that I said it anyway. I'm kind of self-conscious now. It's become that thing. I'm not going to say it now.
It's like feedback though, isn't it? I remember doing said shot. Scottish play, and that there was
it's too late for that. There will be people, by the way, who heard you mention that in a dressing room before a show, and they'll be like,
oh,
fuck you, Keith Fleetwood.
Sorry,
to those
sorry.
People, I say, grow up, it's a word.
Well, I think if you're in it, okay, I think if you're in it and currently doing it, it's fine, because what else are you supposed to do? But I was having a ciggy in the interval, and we were in New York, and where I would have my cigarette was like this little alleyway down the side, and it was right next to the exit doors of the auditorium, and I didn't really realise that. And I could just hear people talking in the interval, going, "Well, she and here and shit." And it's you just got to be careful about overhearing.
She's more attractive in the photographs.
Oh my god, she just does. Oh my god, do you think she's like got a really massive face? Yeah.
Fuck them.
And so you. That's the thing, isn't it? Feedback is good when it's good.
Yeah, you only want it if it's positive. You can't pick and choose.
So I tend to stay away from it.
Yeah, you have to treat good and bad reviews with the same level of disdain.
That's it.
Otherwise, you're kind of screwed. You talked earlier about breaks anyway. You mentioned the fact you think it's, you know, very few of us are lucky enough to have one of those moments that breaks us, and it's like a little chipping away at something bigger.
Mm.
Do you think talent is the most important thing? Do you think luck plays a part? And if it's a mixture, like how do you see that? How do you understand?
I mean, obviously talent plays a part, but I see too many really, really talented people not being used for
Thank
it
you.
To be.
It's good of you to notice.
True.
It means a lot. Normally people don't comment on my acting, but it's nice to be in a room with someone.
No, but you know, we all have that, don't we? We're like, why is that person not?
Of course.
What is wrong?
Everybody went to college with someone where they trained or went to university or at school and they were the best actor. And I, like, you know, people and you were like, they should be doing this and they don't. And sometimes it's choice and other times it's because it doesn't happen for them in 2 years or 10 years or whatever.
Mm.
Of course, right?
Yeah.
But
I think it's a load of things. I think obviously it's talent and it's luck and it's circumstance, as in, you know, you're available at the time that job might come up.
Yes.
Quite often we're not available for the things that might have completely transformed our lives. My dad used to say this thing. I mean, he has sage advice for someone who was just like a farm manager from Liverpool. But he always say to me, you know, not one thing is the answer. You know, not one thing. Nothing's ever the answer. You know, is that you might go, oh, God, that, if I got that job,
no.
That would be, you know, or this job's going to, like I expressed, you know, you're like, I thought I was probably going to get some good auditions after I came back from New York and I didn't have one in a year. And so it's a lot of, there's those things. So there's luck, you know, circumstance, are you available? Are you well enough? Are you whatever? And then you've got fashion and vogue in the industry.
Yeah,
you know, when I was starting out, everyone had to look like Helena Bonham Carter, and it was more Merchant Ivory. I always thought or dreamt of, you know, oh, maybe one day I could play Tessa the D'Urbervilles in a 6-part BBC drama series. But you know, I hadn't gone to drama school, but I didn't have an agent. You know, no casting directors knew me at all.
Yeah.
And I had a massive face for a young person with big gappy teeth, you know.
I had a massive face for a young person.
I once came out of Tesco's and someone shouted
What is a girl of that age doing with a face of that size?
Like that massive.
Who does she think she is?
Yeah. Wait. Well, someone shouted it across the road at me. when I was about 25. Oi, massive face. I thought, what a weird thing to shout
across a road.
What a weird insult. Anyway,
it's good for stage acting, though. You think about a big auditorium.
Apparently, I'd be a good opera singer.
Big auditorium.
Big mouth. I'm
just joining in now, but I actually think it's ridiculous.
So Vogue, in that you know, the fashion at that time, you might be the perfect person for a job, but those jobs aren't around yet.
Do you resent it then? Whenever people who you think necessarily aren't as good as you or friends get an opportunity because they're possibly in their look is in fashion or what they offer is in fashion, do you get jealous of people who seem to, say, leapfrog by virtue of an opportunity that has presented itself?
I think jealousy is a really, you know, a thing in our business that all actors have to face, because it is a kind of a, you know, who's at the feast, you know, that how it sort of feels like. You feel like someone's having a lot of helpings there, you know? But people's time comes and goes, you know, so someone who might have been really pigging out in their 20s, you know, it will suddenly flatline in their 30s, and someone who was really, you know, hungry for a really long time suddenly has a moment, and it'll last for as long as it lasts. And so I think ultimately the answer to that is that you just get used to balancing that out in your head mentally, of going, well, you know, that's great. And I, you know, that's so, and I think jealousy is a funny thing, isn't it, as an actor, because it's really unpleasurable experience to feel jealousy. And I know everyone's felt it, envy, jealousy, but it's a really unproductive, nice place to be. And actually it's a paradox, jealousy, isn't it? Because you're jealous of someone for doing something that you would like to do.
Yeah, I mean, for me, if I'm jealous, and I do get jealous, I get jealous of an opportunity rather than the person.
I know that
sounds like a bit of a cop-out.
No.
What I'm saying is, like, I can get jealous of a 25-year-old woman getting a part that I obviously
would be too old for.
10 years ago, maybe, right? What I'm saying is, you know, it's not about whether I was appropriate. It's just, wouldn't that be fucking class?
Yeah.
So it's not like I hate them. It's like, oh, I wish I had an equal and appropriate opportunity for someone of my age and gender. Like that's...
I think that's what we all feel, is that, you know, it's about opportunity.
Yeah.
Because you can't do a job that you're not right for. And you can't be good in a job that you're not right for necessarily. And so it's just about feeling like you're just being invited to the same opportunities. And that's the thing. I mean, I remember once having, you know, I've played a lot of really tiny parts in massive films. Brothers in arms there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there was one, and at the time I was really down because I had really bad acne. And I think for an actress who was 27, and it came from nowhere and lasted about 2 years. It was just a fucking disaster. And I went to this, and I felt really shit. I auditioned, this is what often happens, you audition for a bigger part, and then they'd give you the tiny part because they really liked you and they really want you in the film. And you're like, okay. And I had, you know...
I've been there a lot.
You know, and it was a film... I won't mention the actress, really famous, now big, massive movie star. And she was just about to hit that movie star thing. And she was really lovely, lovely person. And we got the same car together from set down to the shoe shop that the scene was. And I was playing shoe assistant. And
I thought you were going to say I was playing a shoe. Which would have been amazing.
Well, I do pride myself on my versatility. And she said... we were driving down Bond Street and I was covered in spots and I was being really like miserable. And she was like, so which designer is your favourite designer as we're driving down Bond Street? And I was like, just Topshop. I don't know. Topshop, like Topshop. And I could feel all this resentment burning. And then my one line was, would you like to make your way over to the till, madam? And then, of course, I'd wrapped this whole thing within three shots. And the really sweet first AD went, and that's a wrap on Kate. And the whole crew had literally met an hour before, had to applaud me. And I was like, oh, And I got in the car and I was like, oh, God, I don't know how I'm going to deal with, you know, this side of things. You know? And I just, I had to just do some kind of mental agility that day, which I still do, which is sort of like, I do believe everyone does have their own path. And so I sort of did a bit of visualization again and said, okay, that person's in their little boat and I'm just going to wish them well on their journey. And it just takes away all that resentment if you just go, and that's their life and I have other great things and blessings.
Yeah.
And but it is opportunity. I think that's what we all feel. It's like, I just really like to,
and it's also that thing,
the chance,
like,
to have a go.
Yeah, I think once you divorce everything from its context, you know, like, I wish I had that opportunity, but you don't necessarily think what goes with it and what the cost of it is.
Yeah, and it may not have worked out well for you.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly.
It might have been not very good for you.
Yeah.
Anyway, is acting hard, Kate Fleetwood? Is it difficult?
Sometimes you can have a scene which you go, I never get this right. This is like, I just always know this is going to be, oh, I'm going to have to really truth pump here. Yeah, I'm going to have to like push my foot on it.
Kate, you know, mimes pumping with her feet.
I'm truth pumping because I just don't believe myself in this bit. You know, and in rehearsal she goes,
a line.
I just don't believe myself. I don't believe myself. Never believe myself in this. I can't. And then you might have a little light bulb moment. You go, oh, I know how I would think that, and that is now how I think. But there's often in every play I've done, there's always one bit which you go, I buy it, I get it, you know, but it's a gear change. I'm malfunctioning.
Do you ever feel like you're?
But then you're over it before it's, you know.
Do you ever feel like you're not a very good actor?
Oh God, yeah. Oh God! I mean, yeah.
Yesterday,
I had an audition.
I had two auditions.
And I was like, "Oh my God, that was awful! I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed."
Yesterday, I had two auditions, and I came out. And I said to Bruno on the phone, "I said, I don't think I'm very good at this." She was like, "What do you mean?" I didn't believe a second of either of those auditions. Like, not one second.
Were they film auditions, camera?
Yeah,
auditions? Yeah. I think that's more common.
I did not believe. I was just in there going.
And I was like that.
But just going, this is all pretend. Like, because it was required.
Oh, you were sort of like being John Malkovich, sort of like you were in a.
I was outside of myself going, this is all, you're pretending right now. Whereas I think sometimes in my kind of artistic soul, I expect I'm going to be in the moment and I'm going to feel genuine fear. And you know, like, so actually you're just, I'm faking it. I just felt like I was faking it.
But there's those stories. I think I feel that all the time on screen auditions, always. Because
it's a fake setup.
It's such a fake. It's even more fake than a setup on a set, which is really fake. You know, no one ever stands that close to each other normally. No one ever kind of whispers like that, really, gently. No, that's not real, but it is on camera. It looks real. So, but there's lots of, you know, there's all those stories where filmmakers have taken a, you know, done a shot of a guy who's just sitting there doing nothing. And then they make a shot of a coffin with a dead person in it. And then they change that second shot to a baby or whatever. And then they shoot back to, you know, cut back to the guy. And he doesn't know what he's looking at because they just got a camera on him. And they edit the shot and everyone goes, wasn't he amazing? He was amazing. His reactions, his connection to that coffin or whatever. It's because it's just how you lead the audience. It's not, so it feels really fake.
All of this, feeling like you're terrible at what it is you do for a living, all of this, you know, dealing with rejection, dealing with the fact that you're out of work, fluctuating incomes, does that plus what you do when you do have a job, i.e. pretend to be someone you're not and possibly put yourself in, I don't know, emotional states that aren't particularly enjoyable, does it have a psychological effect, do you think, on the people that do it, i.e. you and I, more specifically, you?
I think the psychological, I was going to say toll, but that probably sounds a bit dramatic, of not being in work when you're an actor, it's really hard. You have to be really strong, and I've got better at that. I mean, I used to be not good, you know. Now if I don't get a job, I can get over it. I'll give probably get over it in an afternoon, but it used to take like a month.
Yeah. You know? But that's only one. Not getting the job is one thing. The other thing is not having a job.
Yeah. So that stuff is hard. And then having to, you know, leaning on the people in your life continually for that kind of, oh, I just feel so, well, yeah. Don't worry, it's something, you know. So I've got better at that, but it is hard. That's hard. And then the psychological stuff of, it's not psychological, it's a logistical stuff of going, oh my God, I've got loads of stuff to do with the kids. I've planned to do, you know, well, actually you can't plan as an actor, but, you know, I'm due to do this afternoon, but I'm like, oh, right, I've got to read 6 scripts and I've got to be off book for them by tomorrow, 10 o'clock. And I had a dentist appointment for my tooth that is really an agony, you know, all that stuff. They have to cancel continually. You know, that does get you down. It's just like, oh, I just can't.
Or family birthdays.
Yeah, like,
or
I can't go to that wedding. I can't do that.
Pandus.
You know, I went to a funeral not long ago and had to go, you know, left and was on stage in a matinee. That's not unheard of for a lot of people who have to go back to work. But, I mean, I always think about, is it psychologically hard being an actor? It's taxing. I think working in a hospice is probably psychologically harder.
You have to remind yourself.
And I do, and I always think that. I always think, I'm not working in a hospice. You know, I'm not having to deal with, you know, that. Or I'm not teaching 35 kids all day.
Is it worth it?
Yeah. The psychological toll of the actual performing, it does take its toll, and each character will have its own toll. Like, some characters you will physically take a whole morning when you wake up to unfurl from, because they've actually just literally ripped through your body. And you know, you have to have a hot bath, and then before you know it, you're on doing matinee again, but you do get there. So it's sort of a physical toll. And then some characters are a psychological toll that, you know, you find that it takes you a few hours to just wind back psychologically. But to be honest, I like being in a company of actors, you know, love being like on stage in a warm-up, playing games, being daft, and that's my favourite thing, being in a rehearsal room more and more. The rehearsal room is the place that I like being more and more, and that's why I like workshopping new plays and stuff, because that's the stuff, that's where all the nice magic happens. Yeah. And of course it's really nice being on stage and giving your performance, whatever, but it's actually I much prefer being in a rehearsal room now.
Have you ever thought about giving up?
I did, yeah. But I know a lot of people say this, but I just don't know what else I do. Because it's the physical feeling, I suppose. That's what it feels like. It feels so physical. And when you're doing it, not doing it, I think it must be a little bit like being, someone who is involved in sport or something, because it's a physical feeling, acting, that connection and that all that stuff that's going on when you're connecting with other people on stage. And I sort of feel that the best place in the whole world to be is in a rehearsal room, because it's a level playing field. So no matter who you are, what you've done, and where you've come from, everyone's in the same vulnerable position. And it's a great way of being the best person you can be.
Do you consider yourself successful?
I think that success is a lot of little things. So I feel I feel psychologically successful that I now no longer sort of, you know, feel traumatized when I go and get a job. That to me is a success as an actor, to go, I can handle that. That's a success. And then I suppose financially as well, when I look at, you know, I look at my tax returns, I go, you know, when I started earning more than £7,000 and my outgoings were, you know, my deductible outgoings were sort of, I still was making a bit more on top of that. Yeah. I was like, oh, I've made more than £8,000 this year.
I'm in profit. Yeah, I'm in profit.
You know, that felt like a massive shift. And then creatively, successfully, if one is to feel successful, I think I feel successful in the sense that I feel like people might want to work with me.
yeah,
and appreciate what I can bring to the table, and that there's going to be a dialogue about that, and that I can be involved in discussions about things, and that to me feels like in a world which is really hard to break into, then to stay in it and not necessarily become a massive star or, you know, be a big household name, but to be employed by the same people because they like working with you.
So from this position of relative wisdom, let's say, relative wisdom, where you've accepted that you know how to cope better and you've learned a lot, and if you could go back to yourself much earlier in your career, so probably you could go back as far as coming out of university and not quite knowing anything about the industry, or you could go back a little less further than that if you thought it was still useful. What advice might you offer younger Kate to shorten the process to get where you are today?
Oh, shorten the process will make it less painful. I mean,
well, there you go. I mean, either to smooth the path.
I think smoothing the path, because I don't think you can shorten the process. I think it'll just be what it is. I don't think there are shortcuts. Yeah, I don't think there are. I'd say you will grow into yourself. So don't worry. I think that's a big thing for you. I'm sure young actors, I remember feeling it. It's like I'm going to miss my, the moment's going to go. And I'm, and that kind of, you know, that panic of like, it's got to happen now. I've got to be the young Vic now. I mean, it's funny because the industry's changed so much. I mean, the idea of like, I know a young, like say maybe young actors now, you know, feel like they've got to go to Hollywood or they've got to be like in a massive big hit on telly. I mean, I was just really, really, really excited about being in the Christmas show at the Young Vic. You know, that was, to me, it was like, I'm in the Christmas show at the Young Vic.
That still sounds pretty awesome to me. Like,
do you know what I mean? But that would, that people, that see, you know, I was playing my violin and being an actor muso for years.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be like, No, and the idea that anyone would ever get sort of nominated for an award or something like that would be like, that's just like, you know, that's just miles away. That's another planet. But I do, what I would say about growing into myself is that you've got to know who you are. I think it'd be crazy to sort of say to any young actor, and I don't mean that sort of like, you know, get a publicist and all of that stuff. But you've got to be aware of what you look like. And you've got to go, that's my flavor.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to beat myself up for not looking like, you know, Helena Bonham Carter. Yeah, or, you know, I can't do anything about not being seen as a blonde ingenue. You know, I'll grow into the massive face. And, you know, those things will, they may pay off later on. And I suppose what I've learned, you know, is like a lot of people in my position would say, is that it really, really is a long game, and you'll grow into yourself. So don't panic. And read more plays when you're unemployed.
This has been one of the more enjoyable interviews, I have to say, because I haven't had to work extremely hard, and the conversation has naturally come around to the topics I feel like that I wanted to talk about. So thank you.
Pleasure.
Genuinely, I've said it halfway through, this feels like we're having a chat as opposed to me asking a series of questions. So that's great. So before I ask the last question, thanks again.
Oh no, it's a pleasure.
It's been an absolute
pleasure. It's real, it's a real honour. Thank you.
I don't know about that.
Being on Desert Island Discs.
We'll see. Oh,
it?
If only.
Kirsty.
If only. I would love that job. It's such a great show. Anyway,
I think you'd be very good.
I don't know about it. But
you know, maybe you'll grow into it.
Maybe I'll grow into it. I'll grow into myself once I give up on this acting malarkey. So, last question. Are you in anything at the minute?
Not right now, but I'm about to start filming.
Lovely. Thanks again. It's been wonderful. Cheers for your time.
Thank you.
And that's it for episode 1. Amazing. If you enjoyed that, and if you want to listen to another episode straight away, and let's face it, it's that time of year, you may just want to take yourself off to a quiet cupboard with a bottle of port and a blanket and listen to this podcast until January. So, episode 2, as is traditional for this podcast, has gone out today as well. So you need to do nothing except sit and wait. And episode 2, if the technology plays ball, should automatically queue up. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to share your favourite moments with the hashtag #BestOfHonestActors. Don't forget, if you like, to leave a rating and a review on the podcast app of your choice. That would be very much appreciated and in the spirit of the season. And also, even if you don't want to talk about it in social media and you don't want to leave a rating and review, humbug, just tell your mates that the podcast is back. Word of mouth is still a thing in 2018. It may still be a thing in 2019. I hope it is. Please tell everyone. That's it for me for now, until you queue up episode 2, and I'll start again. Speak to you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.